The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As the New England fishing season gets underway, those who've long plied our waters for cod face severe limits, a 75% cut in how much they can take, on top of a similar cut last year. It's part of a long, angry story of fishermen and federal regulators sharply disagreeing over the health of New England cod stocks. But while that battle continues, other models are emerging. Many fishermen will head out in their boats this year looking for other species whose populations are in good shape, such as hake or wolffish or dogfish, aided by improved nets so that they only catch what they're supposed to. And then back on land, there are growing efforts to help expand local markets for that local catch. Today in The Exchange, the future of New England fishing. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests for the hour. Joining us from the seacoast is David Gaethel, longtime New Hampshire fisherman with a boat based out of Hampton. He also worked as a research biologist and has served on several state and federal fishery management boards. And David Gaethel, welcome back. Good to have you.
Yes, good morning, Laura.
Also with us in studio, Andrea Tomlinson, General Manager of New Hampshire Community Seafood, which operates the state's only community-supported seafood program. Andrea, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura. Pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Eric Chapman, Commercial Fisheries Specialist at New Hampshire Sea Grant and UNH Cooperative Extension. He focuses on fishing gear technology. And Eric, good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And also with us, Gabriella Brott, Commercial Fisheries Specialist, again, at New Hampshire Sea Grant. She focuses on direct marketing of seafood. And Gabriella, nice to meet you. Thank you also.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and all of you, everybody talks about the need to preserve this industry in New Hampshire. Maybe I'll turn to you first, Gabriella. Why is that? I mean, we don't whale anymore. We don't make textiles anymore. Why do we still need to go out and fish?
Because people still love seafood. And in New Hampshire, we have a really, and in New England in general, we have a very long history of fishing. And it's part of the culture. And it would be, I think it would be very difficult to lose that industry here, especially in New Hampshire, since it's such a part of who we are.
What do you think, Eric?
Well, I agree with what Gabby said. We also, you know, our fishermen are mostly sort of nearshore fishermen. They're day boat fishermen, sort of the equivalent of small farmers, I guess, small family farmers. So they're used to kind of going out in the morning, coming back in the evening, fishing stocks that come to them. It's a very seasonal fishery, and so it changes from one season to the next. They hold a tremendous amount of ecological knowledge that would be lost if we lose these small boat fishermen. So there are many reasons. It's good for the fishery to have such boats on the water. These fishermen are a wealth of knowledge, and they provide, you know, an important service for our community, and they always have.
David, what do you think?
Well, I'd like to use this figure to kind of elucidate the problem. There are between 3.5 and 4 billion people in this world who get most or all of their protein sustenance from seafood. This is a matter of economic security to the United States to be able to harvest fish and feed people.
So to the question of why we need to keep this in New England, though, I mean, most of the seafood that we eat comes from elsewhere. Why keep this small New England, New Hampshire fishing fleet?
Well, I mean, I think it's the same thing. We need to sustainably harvest seafood. It's a matter of feeding people. Doesn't matter whether it's New England or anywhere else in the world. You know, we have insufficient protein in the world to continue to feed a growing population, and we need to find a way to balance these competing needs.
What is a sustainable fishery? I think I'll turn to you first, Andrew. What does that mean? And we're going to talk a lot about that this hour, what a sustainable New England fishery would mean. What do you think?
Well, a sustainable fishery, Laura, is one that can actually go out, fish, and know that they're not really disrupting the population that could further reproduce the next year, right? So you want to make sure that you're sustaining the population and not taking a breeding stock that would prevent reproduction of that species in an allowable portion that can be commercially fished for the next year.
And is New England's fishing industry sustainable?
Well, they're trying. So what's happening is what we're really trying to do with the community-supported fishery and the restaurant-supported fishery with our organization is support fishermen who are going out and fishing for the alternative species as opposed to cod. So that's a way of keeping New Hampshire fisheries sustainable, is looking at what used to be called, what we were discussing earlier, trash fish. We like to refer to them as underutilized fish.
Underloved.
Underutilized. And really introducing the consumer, both the restaurant consumer and the personal consumer, to alternative species of fish that are being fished sustainably right now in New Hampshire.
Well, I definitely want to talk about that this hour, you know, trying to change consumer tastes and consumer habits. But I think to you, Gabriella, you know, even if New Hampshire and New England were models of sustainability when it came to fishing, you know, there are big, giant factory trawlers, so they call them, these huge boats from all over the world, just outside the limits of our fishery. Does it matter if New England is sustainable, given the huge international pressures?
Yes, I think it does, because we have, within our own Gulf of Maine waters, we have those populations of fish that we do also need to protect. And even though other big boats can come in, they can decimate those populations very quickly. If we insist on keeping our own day boats alive, if you will, we can keep those populations going and we can harvest them sustainably. And one point I wanted to make is that another feature, at least in New Hampshire, for sustainability is sort of the local seafood access and the fact that because we are so small, we are such a small fleet, we're technically sustainable, because even if we fished all day, every single day, you know, for a million years, we can't take enough out to actually, you know, have an issue. So, and all of our fishermen do it properly. They do follow the NOAA regulations. And I think that's one of the frustrating parts, is that the misconceptions between how we do it, what we're doing, and what the public sees, you know, it's sort of this broad cloth or broad sweep of, well, if they're catching cod, they must be doing it badly, which is not necessarily the case. They're still following the rules and regulations that NOAA sets forth.
So, Eric, this is a really sort of technical question, but can those big boats that are often blamed for overfishing and, you know, decimating populations, can they come into New England waters, or are waters sort of protected from those giant boats? That's my first question. My second question maybe is more for David. Do the fish, you know, stay within largely New England boundaries, or do they go off to be captured by these giant boats? Go ahead, Eric.
Well, for the most part, I mean, the topic of boat size in the Gulf of Maine is kind of a hot topic. And in many ways, the management has set up sort of a conflict between the smaller boats and the larger boats. But the larger boats in that continuum are not probably what you might be envisioning as sort of these factory vessels. They're
picturing. Yeah, they come
more
in and
the
they
order
just sweep everything up.
I don't know, 60 feet, something along those lines. And the smaller boats that are our fishermen are mostly in the sort of the 40s, I guess. So by and large, access to the groundfish fishery is limited to, you know, relatively small vessels. And the Gulf of Maine is less vulnerable to these large factory trawlers.
So are they just not allowed?
Well, in the shift to sector management, which is the type of management that's in play right now, the quotas of fish are assigned to fishermen who historically have fished these in these fisheries. And that included these, you know, set of Gloucester boats, all the boats in New Hampshire and Maine and Massachusetts that have historically fished for those stocks. No one else is allowed into the fishery.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. David, I'd love your thought on that too. Not only just the big boats and whether they try to sneak in, but also do the fish stay in one place? Maybe they head further out and they can get swept up.
Well, there's two questions there. I think in answer to your first question, there has not been what you call factory trawlers off the coast of New England since the mid-1970s when the Magnuson Act was passed, the so-called 200-mile limit. Our exclusive economic zone extends out to 200 miles, which is beyond the continental slope.
So it's pretty far and pretty big.
Very deep water. These fish are a prisoner of depth, if you will, to some degree. They're not going to swim around in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in 15 to 20,000 feet of water. You know, in answer to the second question, yes, they do have tails and they do swim. And they, you know, as I like to tell people, God gave them a tail for a reason, and they know how to use it. And they are principally a prisoner of water temperature, and they seek certain narrowly defined temperature zones, and they move around based on those zones, whether it's inshore and offshore, between winter and summer, or northeast, southwest, up and down the coast of the United States and Canada. So I guess the long answer to that question is, yes, we do have stock boundary issues. We share a boundary of a portion of that 200-mile limit with Canada. There's no chain-link fence out there, no immigration or anything. They don't carry passports. so they know how to swim across that border.
You know, you mentioned water temperature real quick, David. You know, we do hear about the warming of the seas, especially in the Gulf of Maine. Do you think that's one of the reasons why scientists from the federal government are seeing fewer cod, that they're heading north?
Well, that's very much an issue here. The we're at the southern end of the range of a number of species. Cod, yellowtail flounder, and northern shrimp would probably be the ones that people in New Hampshire would be most familiar with. Because of that, as the water's warm, the fish move to the north and east. And some NOAA scientists have studied this and have actually been quite good at predicting what would happen. And unfortunately, other NOAA scientists aren't really paying attention to the information they've produced. So the Gulf of Maine is warming, as are all the waters, all the oceans. But the Gulf of Maine, for reasons that aren't clearly understood at the moment, is warming faster than 99-odd% of the rest of the ocean, warming very, very quickly. As a result, things like cod that are cold water species are really caught in a trap. They can go deeper to some degree where the water is colder. They can move to the north and east, perhaps into areas outside their native stock range. Other than that, the only alternative is temperature-induced mortality.
All right. David, I got to cut you off there, but we will talk a lot more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the future of fishing and New Hampshire's local seafood. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We have four guests this hour. David Gaethel, longtime New Hampshire fisherman. He's based out of Hampton. Also with us, Eric Chapman and Gabriella Brott. They're both with New Hampshire Sea Grant and UNH Cooperative Extension, focusing on different aspects of commercial fisheries. And also with us, Andrea Tomlinson. She's general manager of New Hampshire Community Seafood. That's like a CSA, but for fish. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Gabriella, here's a question that I think a lot of our listeners may be wondering. Where does most of the fish that we get at the grocery store come from?
From everywhere else but.
But New England.
But New England, or actually the U.S. Most of our fish is actually caught in the U.S., and about 90% of it is exported back out. So it's a lot easier to get things processed and refrozen and repackaged, et cetera, and then brought back into the United States. So what we catch is actually usually shipped out. And usually a lot of it goes back to China where it's processed for a much cheaper price. And then we get it back in. So we actually eat a lot more imported fish than we actually eat of our own. And then that's what we normally see in our grocery stores. And some of it is originally comes from the United States. So you do see, you know, Alaskan pollock and salmon and stuff like that. But it's been sort of around the world.
Now,
before
that's
we get
really
it back.
Interesting. So if I see fish from Finland or Norway or China, it might actually be it might have been caught off of American waters.
Sometimes.
But then so how do I know really where that fish, you know, sort of grew up?
It's almost impossible to tell. I mean, that's why there's a lot of this sort of, know the push for know your fishermen, know your food. Where did it come from? Because it's really hard to trace. And one of the things that we're trying to look for, or the consumer is trying to push for, is more transparency and more traceability in your seafood, so you know where it's coming from and you know what you're getting is actually what is on the label.
That's interesting, because you see those little countries of origin when you go to the grocery store, but you're saying not necessarily.
Not necessarily, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe grew up off the coast of New England, but was an exchange student, so to speak,
yeah.
in China or somewhere else. You know, and so do you, Andrea Tomlinson. Again, you know, your whole business is getting people to eat more local seafood. Why isn't it local? Why can't I get, you know, Hampton Beach cod from David Gaethel at my local Hannaford's?
That's right, Laura. Well, 98% of New Hampshire seafood is exported out of the state. So what's happening with our sector fleet, a sector being a group of fishermen that cooperatively fish together, is that they're selling the majority of their fish at auction. Both the Boston and the Portland auction come in and buy the fish daily. The prices change according to market supply and demand. And this is oftentimes a question for me, too. I'm a big supporter of eating local, and I'd like to know where my fish is coming from. I happen to live across from Johnson's Dairy Bar in Northwood, and I oftentimes ask, where is this haddock from? And oftentimes the server doesn't know, or she'll say, I think it's from Norway, maybe Iceland. There's just a real lack of, transparency, even with maybe some restaurants, as to, you know, keeping track of where your fish is from. So to get back to the original question, a lot of the fish is being sold in bulk and commercially.
So it's like a commodity almost.
It truly is. So to get that 2% of the fish that we're keeping in the state, I'm literally dealing with either a broker or a fisherman's personal broker to buy that fish directly from that fisherman.
Here's an email from Brendan that I want to share with you, and then I'll turn to you, too, David and Eric. Brendan says, I'm a chef on the seacoast. As a community of chefs, most of us are only buying local sustainable species. Customers may need a bit of education, but if it is delicious, they will buy it. Brendan says, cod, like salmon, is popular because the fat content makes it forgiving and allows it to keep for a long time. Pollock, redfish, king, whiting, wolffish, he says, are all delicious, but they have to be eaten fresh and not overcooked. Brendan says, go to your market, not the grocery store, and ask questions. Ask at your favorite restaurant. They will help. So, David Gaethel, let's say you arrive back at the docks with your boat. You've got a bunch of fish. Where does it go? Can you sell it locally, or do you have to send it to one of these sort of commodity markets in Portland or Boston?
Well, one of the requirements of the federal government is that we can only sell our fish to a licensed wholesaler. I can't sell to a person who comes down the dock. So the person has to have a dealer permit. So that limits the number of people I can sell to radically. The second thing is that my fish has to go somewhere where somebody will buy all of it. I can't skim off the cream, if you will, and be left with the rest. My fish is sold at the Yankee Fishermen's Co-op in Seabrook. They have a fish market, and they sell some of the fish out of the fish market to the public. And the majority of it is trucked to places, as other people have said, in New England, Portland, Gloucester, Boston, New York, Montreal, Toronto. We distribute fish pretty much around, the northeastern part of North America.
Thanks for that email, Brendan. And again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Let's go to our callers. And David's calling from Woodstock. Hey, Dave, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to bring to light, does threats of larger boats is not just an international thing. About 4 years ago, I'm a charter boat captain out of Massachusetts. And about 4 years ago, we watched boats that were in the 100 to 150-foot range that were from New Bedford and Gloucester pretty much camped out on Stellwagen Bank for probably a month, 2 months in November. And we knew what they were doing. And then we watched our cod numbers deplete over the course of that winter. And then a couple winters later, now can't catch cod at all. And, you know, I just think people should know that that big boat threat is not an international thing. There are boats out of Gloucester that are perfectly capable of wiping out our inshore fishery.
Wow. Okay, Dave, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Eric Chapman, please.
Yeah, one of the results of sector transition to sector management is that fishermen can now lease or purchase quota from other fishermen and compile fish that they haven't historically fished for. So one of the results of that is that some of these larger boats have purchased quota for Gulf of Maine cod, for example, and quite a bit of it, so that they are now coming into some of these nearshore areas and fishing in places that they had never fished before. So sector management enables the fishermen to fish a little bit more when and where they would like, rather than just sort of where they historically have fished offshore of their home port.
And
so I think that's one of the observations that was just shared by the caller. That's a result of that transition.
And this is a real technical term, but since you mentioned it, we should just describe a little bit. Sector management, I've heard it described as like carbon trading, pollution credits. It's sort of the same setup where if you overfish or if somebody underfishes in one area, you can trade fish credits with someone else. Go ahead. You can explain it better than I
can. That's right. So I'll take a stab at it. Just like anything in fisheries, it can get complicated very fast. So sectors are groups of fishermen. They've self-organized into a cooperative, harvest cooperatives is one term that's been used to describe them. And the groups of fishermen share their quota for a portfolio of species that they're assigned during a fishing year. Once the sector goes over for any of the stocks that they have a quota for, the entire sector must stop fishing. So if the sector runs out of cod, for example, the entire sector will need to stop fishing.
And David, is this better for you as a fisherman compared to how they used to do it, which is, you know, you can go out, you know, 30 days this year and 32 days next year and so forth? Is this a better system or does it have its own problems?
No, it has its own problems. There is no perfect system of fisheries management. That's the biggest problem. I think from a personal point of view, when I was a manager, I would have put forward the system we had, the days at sea and the trip limits, but with full retention. So in other words, if there was an 800-pound limit of cod, if you caught 2,000 pounds instead of throwing over 1,200, some of which die, you kept all 1,200 and then took the time penalty at the dock. I think it would have been simpler. I think it would have allowed us to keep moving forward. But that was not to be. The federal government had this very strong push from the head of NOAA, a woman named Jane Lubchenco, to install these catch share systems throughout the United States. And, you know, I may not exactly agree with what the caller said about cause and effect as to what happened to the cod, but the fact is that it did allow a restructuring of the fishery with a clear goal on the part of the United States government to have consolidation, to reduce the number of boats, and to have fewer, larger boats. That was the goal of this project, and it's been spectacularly successful so far.
Thanks for that call again, Dave. And thanks for the email earlier, Brendan. Our number on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Another Dave is with us, Dave from Exeter. Hi, Dave, go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say that it's a source of New Hampshire pride, I think, for people to support the fishing industry here in the state, because commercial fishermen and women are super creative when it comes to trying to provide food for the area, and creative in ways that they're, I know they're doing aquaculture, and they're doing different things to try to bring different products to market. I just think it's really important for consumers to be equally creative and to be equally excited about trying new things and supporting that. So really, anybody who goes to a farmer's market really should be seeking out some of these regional seafoods. They ought to see what a periwinkle tastes like. They ought to check out the squid when they come in the summer. And then there's also these great cultural connections. Eels are big in Italian cuisine, and you can learn all about Italy through eating some local eels. So I just think there's a lot of rich stories around fish that people can get excited and then just kind of build local pride.
So, Dave, you're saying get out of the routine of eating salmon and cod and flounder all the time. Try some of the other stuff.
Well, yeah, absolutely that. And then, you know, I mean, who has a good story about a cow? Really nobody, right? But there's lots of people.
I don't know.
Lots of people have good stories about this striped bass I caught, or I think just getting excited about seafood again, because we've been bombarded with a lot of stories about how contaminants are a problem, how pollution, you know, mercury levels, and then overfishing. There's just lots of bad stories. And certainly if anybody's ever eaten a bad piece of fish that isn't fresh, that'll stick with you for a long time.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling in. Gabriella, and also you, Andrea. Gabriella, you first. You know, what he says is interesting. Bad stories about contaminants, depleted fisheries. Here's a Facebook comment from Stephen who says, you can't win when it comes to eating fish. Either you're eating wild-caught and depleting the fisheries, or you're eating farm-raised and polluting the ocean and wild gene pools. Stephen says it's lose-lose. What about that? Some people feel guilty eating fish.
Yeah, well, that's
unsure eating fish.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the issue is there's so much information being bombarded at you all the time, you know, with with the different recommendations. This fish is bad. This fish is caught badly, and this one will, you know, has too much mercury, et cetera, et cetera. And I think part of my job at Sea Grant and Extension is to try and educate people and say, you know, yes, you have to. You have to weigh all these things. This is what part of being a responsible and well-informed consumer is. But it's not all, you know, bad news at all. And
so what's the good news? Because, you know, just speaking as a consumer, I read, oh, fish is great. It's got omegas. It's got this. It's got that. But then, you know, the next time you open the newspaper, you also hear about mercury and other contaminants.
Right. So, I mean, one of the things that we're trying to encourage people to do is just like what the caller said, is to go find out more and to try different species. So, yeah, get off the cod and salmon bandwagon and go for different species that we actually do have plenty of quota for. We can catch, and they're not so expensive, and it's caught here. One of the examples is pollock and redfish, and they are delicious fish, and softshell lobster is another one that we're trying to, you know, promote and educate people about, that just because it's not, you know, your run-of-the-mill fish, it's actually just as good for you and probably your best bet and sustainable. So it definitely requires a little bit of legwork on your part as a consumer. But I also think that it's not, you know, it's all not all doom and gloom. And the caller's right. Know your fishermen. They give you so much information, and they can tell you, no, this was, you know, the best thing you can do is eat something fresh that was caught right here in the Gulf of Maine, or, you know, inshore, et cetera, et cetera, because you know where it came from.
Although, and Andrea, I know you're jumping to get in there, but David told us earlier, and Andrea too, that it's hard to do what you just said, Gabriella, you know, buy it from your local fisherman. I mean, David said he can't, you know, give me a couple pounds off the dock. He has to sell it in these sort of established markets.
Right. And that's sort of where, you know, Eric and Andrea and I come in that we say, actually, you can buy Dave's fish at Yankee Co-op. And maybe there's not a ton of it, but it's there. Or, you know, hey, let's sign up for the CSF share, because she works with the, you know, the ground fish sector all the time, and she can get you that fish. So, yeah, we don't have a lot around here, but it is accessible if you know where to look. And that's part of my job, is to tell people where to find it.
So. Well, and to our caller, Dave's point, you know, Andrea, get a little more excited about the unusual species. When I was growing up fishing, and I did grow up fishing, I was only interested in the flounder.
I grew up fishing too.
You know, yeah. The other fish, we called them trash fish. We
right.
threw them back.
Right. Flounder was actually one of the first fish I ever caught off the coast of New Jersey. And I grew up fishing a lot. And the fish that we're offering through the CSF, and just along the same lines with what Dave was saying, I've had a lot of members of the CSF say, this is so great. I support what you're doing. I remember when my grandfather used to take me down to the docks and buy fish right off of his friend's boat, and we'd go home and cook it and have a fish fry with the family. It's a nostalgic thing, and it's a way for people to connect with their culture and their, you know, feel-good memories about their childhood, about growing up near the sea and eating fresh seafood. You know, we'd catch fish right off the dock in New Jersey and go crabbing on the pilings and eat that the same night. And there's nothing better than a delicious flounder that you've just caught. So thank you, Dave from Exeter. You didn't mention dogfish and how delicious that is. But
those are one of the ones where we went, ick.
However,
no,
Laura, however,
this was a bunch of years ago, but.
Right. Dogfish is the most commonly used fish in Europe for fish and chips. So if you're in Europe, anywhere in Europe, and you order fish and chips, that is most likely dogfish, otherwise known as Cape Shark. And it's really good. It's firm and fleshy, and it's got a great flavor. It's all about how you cook it and how you marinate it, really.
So where does this sort of prejudice come from, or this ick factor? We don't want to eat dogfish or eel or skate.
Well, I think people are thinking, excuse me, of those fish as bycatch. Oh, that's just what the fishermen used to catch when they were targeting cod or when they were targeting haddock. You know, I heard that's what they caught in the net as you know, the other fish that was out there in the sea. But actually, all those fish that are bycatch are white, either firm or fleshy, delicious white fish that can be marinated or seasoned and made to taste just as delicious as a cod or a haddock fillet. And it's all about how you cook it, really. And we offer recipes to our members.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Eric Chapman, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think also it's a part of we've culturally lost our connection to the ocean and what the ocean can provide in a sustainable fashion. So our tastes and our markets have converged on sort of just a few species, and we've lost sort of our openness to eating a broader range of species. And if you look at the menus of restaurants along the coast, you know, 100 plus years ago, would have had all of these things that we might say ick about. And today they only have maybe two, you know, three or four different types of fish on the menu.
Interesting. So people's tastes were a little more diverse,
yeah,
100 years or so ago. All yes. right. And David Gaethel, coming up, I do want to ask you also about bycatch, what that is, how that plays into this whole issue of sustainable fishing that we're talking about. Plus your phone calls, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about local seafood and the fishing industry in New Hampshire, which has been struggling under federal limits on cod and other species. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And David Gaethel, someone here in studio mentioned the word bycatch just before the break, and I did want to ask you a couple questions about that, because that plays into what we're talking about today. First of all, just remind us, David, what is bycatch?
Okay, most basically bycatch is untargeted species. In other words, you're fishing for one thing and you're catching something else. It may still be something you want, but it's not what you're targeting.
So what do you do with bycatch? Let's say you're going out for haddock or cod and you end up grabbing other stuff. What do you do with it?
Well, in the sector system for groundfish and what you just mentioned, you're required by law to keep it all. So if I target haddock and I catch cod, I have to keep the cod. When I'm out of cod, I can no longer target haddock. But in other fisheries, let's say silver hake or what's called whiting here in New England, we use a bycatch reduction net called a raised foot rope trawl, which allows the flounders, the skates, the lobsters, things like that to go right underneath the net. We'll still catch an occasional cod, but we have to throw it back because we're not allowed to keep it in that fishery. So the goal of fisheries technology in the last 30 years has changed dramatically from building better, more efficient nets to building nets that catch more of what you are targeting and less of what you are not targeting.
So from what I understand, David, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, so strict limits on cod. Let's say you decide to go out for another type of fish. but you end up getting a whole bunch of cod in your net. Then you get in trouble, right?
Well, you're essentially shut down for the year.
Wow.
As an example, I have 1,850 pounds of cod. I just got my allocation last night that I can catch for the year. When that 1,850 pounds is gone, I'm done. And that's a real problem because we have 12 stocks here that swim together, you know, cod, haddock, four different kinds of flounders, redfish, pollock, an assortment of hakes, skates, monkfish. They all swim together. And, you know, there's some cod everywhere. So, you know, that is the where we're at in a nutshell is the fact that with these, what I consider to be ridiculously small quotas of cod, most of the fishery will be shut down quite quickly.
Wow. So you're going out to get hake. You say, yep, I hear you on the cod. No problem. I'm going to go get hake because it's plentiful and people want it. But if you have too much cod bycatch, you know, sort of caught by accident, if I could put it that way, you're shut down for the year.
That's correct.
That's a hard place to get out of, Eric Chapman.
Absolutely. It's extremely challenging. And that is the overwhelming limiting factor that's going to affect our fishermen this year is their ability to fish the healthy stocks and avoid cod. And, you know, fishermen, as I think the previous caller, Dave from Exeter, had mentioned, are incredibly creative, and they are extremely knowledgeable about the ecosystem that they are fishing from. Their livelihood depends on their ability to do things that almost seem impossible. But they know, you know, they have a lot of information that can guide when and where they can fish to avoid cod, but they're also good at designing gear and using gear in ways that can be also be selective. And a good example of that is an idea that fishermen had here in New Hampshire to modify gill nets, which is a gear that's placed on the bottom of, on the seabed of the ocean, like lobster gear. It's fixed gear, and then it's left there for 24, 48 hours, and the fisherman returns and pulls up the net. And
just like a lobster trap.
Exactly. And fishermen, you know, understanding that cod may be sort of a limiting species for them, understanding the behavior of fish, they felt that they could avoid cod by raising the bottom of the gill nets off of the seabed, you know, 2 to 6 feet, and still catch pollock or other species that are more abundant. So we worked with them to get some funding for a project to explore this possibility, and through the course of the last 3 years have identified what works for the fishermen here, which is 4 feet off of the bottom. And this has allowed them to continue fishing, avoid cod, and target pollock.
Well, it's tough, though, because as David says, they all swim together.
They all swim together, but there are subtle differences in fish behavior. They are unique species that behave differently. They move around in different ways, but there are, for the most part, generally grouped together.
All right. Did you want to jump in there too, Gabrielle?
No, I just wanted to agree with Eric in that they are different species and they have different behaviors. And just to illustrate that, cod tend to swim right on the bottom, whereas pollock, even though they're, you know, if you will, cousins, they will swim a little bit higher, which is why the raised foot rope works, because they're not all just right there. But if you have something indiscriminate, it will just catch them all. So if you know, playing around with these different foot ropes and different technologies in the gear is really, really helpful.
Okay. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Eric's calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Eric. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Laura. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I just want to express the interest in the show. All the speakers that you have there are very passionate about this particular the fishery in New Hampshire, and the industry is just tremendously challenged under the current regulatory conditions. To the extent that, you know, and I know the show can't go into a lot of the depths of it, but New Hampshire has the potential of actually being eliminated from the fishery under the current regulatory regime. That we, you know, they're small boats. They can't afford to buy quota or this or that, and once these things are a challenge to the dimension that they are at this particular time, you start losing shoreside infrastructure, which is definitely a component of the fishery. The boats are the boats, but the boats need infrastructure on shore to support them, and if those facilities go by, then we step back 40 years, and in a previous time that these boats can't function. These boats are businesses, and they have expenses whether they leave the dock or don't leave the dock, it's very scary for fishermen at this particular time. You know, how are they going to stay in the fishery? There's people like David and a variety of others that are dedicated to try and remain in the fishery, but the challenges are becoming immense.
So what happens, Eric? This is a question that we asked right at the beginning of the show, so I'm glad you called in. I'll ask you. So what happens if this industry goes away? As I started out by asking all our guests, you know, everybody says we need this industry. Well, we don't whale anymore. We don't make shoes really anymore. We don't make textiles anymore. So why do we need the New England and New Hampshire fishing industry? Make the case for us, Eric.
Well, I think it's been made earlier in the show that there's a variety of individuals. The consumers are becoming more informed, although there's a variety of information out there that they should probably look through. The information is volumetric, and sometimes it's not presented in the right way. But people are susceptible to listening to a lot of things. This industry has been in New Hampshire for 400 years. Does that mean it should be here for longer? Yes, it should. But it still gets back to David's original statement that we provide protein, we provide food, we provide a very good product to the residents of this area, all the way across the country. So it's not just the issue is somewhat of a local perspective, but they're providing food and protein, for many people that don't have the ability to live on the seacoast, and so on and so forth. So,
and Eric, I have one more question for you that's been really interesting to me, and I'd love your take on it, since, again, you are a fisherman. Everybody says they want to eat local and sustainable, and yet you go to the grocery store and you can't find a fish from New England. David Gaethel told us that he sells his a little bit locally, but also to sort of brokers or on commodities markets, so to speak. Where does your fish go? Could you sell it off the dock or to the restaurant down the street?
Well, I had a lot of years in the ground fishery, and that's kind of the focus of the discussion. I've gone into another fishery and trying to make it there in the lobster fishery. So, but my passion is with ground fish. It's just, because my passion is with this New Hampshire industry all the way across the board. We're a small community. We're a cooperative community amongst ourselves, but we're concerned about the industry altogether and how it comes together in New Hampshire. So I think, the passion is there, well deeper than the show, I think, can possibly broadcast.
Right.
We got to save this fishery, or we got to save this industry. It provides a lot more to the state and to the seacoast area than just fish. There's a lot of other ingredients into it. Tourism, so on and so forth, and the ambiance of the seeing boats and so on and so forth. So. It's broad ranging, but I just want to really express that there's a great concern that even with the efforts of the speakers that you have on the show to try and maintain it, that there is some immense challenges that could
shut this thing down.
Permanently affect this industry, in the state. And I just hope that the rest of the audience is listening as, a component of the compassion that the speakers have.
Okay.
And listening.
Thank you for calling in, Eric. And I know we've talked before, and it's great to hear from you. And there's a couple points that you made, Eric, that I do want to ask our guests about. So, Andrea, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Well, Eric brings up a good point. A lot of our ground fishermen, excuse me, Eric included, who is a passionate, very popular ground fisherman back in the day, have turned to lobstering. So down at the...
And ground fishing, again, is what?
Ground fishing is catching fish that tend to congregate on the bottom of the sea. So
cod, flounder,
haddock, what we've been speaking
and
about.
Those are the ones that are struggling, right?
Correct. So fish that aren't up in the water column but tend to live towards the bottom of the seabed. All the fish we've been discussing. So a lot of these ground fishermen have turned to lobstering. So the entire pier down at the Portsmouth Commercial Fishing Pier that used to be, 20 years ago, I was going out with both Eric Anderson and other fishermen for research purposes. Those are all lobstermen now, and they're working very hard. doing their lobstering. So lobstering's a whole different game than ground fish. But to stay in the fishery, and I'm assuming to stay in their livelihood, fishermen have chosen to go into lobstering.
Yeah, and we decided not to talk about that other kind of seafood today, just for purposes of making it easy. But I'm glad you said that. And David Gaethel, to you, so what about fishing for those other fish that don't live on the ground, given what we often hear is the collapse of the ground fish? Why not just, and I know this is, it's never easy with fisheries, but why not just go a couple feet up and seek the other fish?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of those fish that live predominantly on the ground also go quite a bit higher than a couple feet up.
Getting into the question we talked about before. Yeah, go ahead, David.
You can't separate them out that way. You know, to the question of why have some people not gone lobstering, that's a limited entry fishery as well. I cannot go lobstering. I have to buy out somebody to do that. And to put it bluntly, I don't have the money to get involved in another fishery. I think there was another question asked that's important to answer, too. Why doesn't Hannaford have my fish or any other supermarket?
Well, yeah, yours or Eric's or anybody's. Yeah, go ahead.
The answer is that they, you know, supermarkets plan their marketing six months out or longer, and they need a sustainable source of fish. And by sustainable in this case, I mean they need it 12 months a year. They need to know they're going to get X amount of pounds every week so they can fill their markets. And because of the way our regulations are set up, we can't provide fish anymore on a year-round basis. So, and, you know, that's the short answer to that question. You know, this isn't a traditional supply and demand setup. If cod quotas are real low, that means the supply is low, the price should skyrocket. But it doesn't, because the fish will be replaced and flown in air freight from Iceland or Norway or Russia overnight. Canada as well. So basically fish prices are flat or declining, and yet we're not allowed to catch any fish. So it's a very difficult, complex situation, not only biologically, but economically as well.
Wow. So the economics are incredibly complicated. Another question for you, Andrea. I was surprised to hear again that your general manager of New Hampshire Community Seafood, operating the state's only community-supported seafood program. Why is there just one CSF, given, you know, that there does seem to be a demand for local fish and a desire on the part of local fishermen to provide it?
Well, that's a great question, Laura. The CSF that we run, New Hampshire Community Seafood, was started 2 years ago by Josh Wiersma and Sarah Van Horn. They've since moved on. Josh is still on our board. And when he started, I think Gabby can confer, we had another CSF that was Eastman's. We're operating as well. And my understanding is there just hasn't really been the infrastructure set up. I can attest that it's a lot of work, but it's really great. And what's going on, I think, is there's a renewed interest in buying local. I think people are getting back to, you know, the original roots of our foreparents of, you know, let's just go down to the dock and get some fish. Well, since, as our callers had said, it's very difficult to do so right now, you can do that through us. So because we're a community-supported fishery, we are buying directly from the New Hampshire boats. And then through our CSF, you can buy that fish directly through us. But as far as, you know, why aren't there any more?
Yeah, just one for the whole state. Doesn't seem like a lot, Gabby.
Yeah, no, there's not. And actually, a few years ago, you know, up to even 5 years ago, there have been these sort of, you know, startups, but they kind of fizzle. There's a lot of different ways to do these CSFs. There's a lot of different models. And I think the reason why this one is successful is because it's not the norm, the normal model. In fact, this one has the fishermen actually buying into the CSF so that they run it, they're responsible for it, and they have a lot more invested. The other ones were sort of seasonal, and you know, once you do one season or two, people would either get disillusioned or it was just too much work, or you know, CSFs are hard to get going. Once they get going, some of them are super successful, but like Andrea said, if the infrastructure is not there, it's really hard to do that.
Well, Eric, I'm going to turn to you last. Why don't you look out 5 years for us? If we sat down again, all four of us, and we said, okay, how's it going? Are these fisheries healthier? Are they more sustainable? Are more people eating local food, including some of that throwback food that a lot of us don't eat? What would we be seeing 5 years from
now?
Well,
I certainly hope that does exist, that we've regained a lively and healthy, vibrant fishing community, and people are enjoying, you know, local seafood, and also our fishermen have other markets that maybe go further away, but deliver, you know, a working wage to them.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gabriella Bach, good to see you too. Thank you for your time. And Andrea Tomlinson, thank you.
Thank you so much, Laura.
And David Gaethel over in Hampton, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Okay. Talk to you again.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.